Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, security briefs.
I read everything that is put in front of me.
Was the Prime Minister properly briefed, or did Justin Trudeau fail to inform himself of potential foreign interference? Our weekly journalist panel will examine the revelations made this week at the Oak Commission and the criticism now being hurled at the Prime Minister. Also,
I find it problematic that the Liberals have set up a divisive system.
With that comment and the NDP support for a carbon pricing First Minister summit, is the party singing a different tune on a key environmental policy? And
no, thank you. We don't need your policy advice on school lunch programs, on pharmacare, on dental care.
We'll speak to the Alberta Premier about her bill that tells Ottawa to stay out of her backyard. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. The Conservative leader took direct aim at the Prime Minister Thursday night, criticizing Justin Trudeau for testimony given at the Foreign Interference Inquiry, in which the Prime Minister said an in-person briefing is what he relies on for priority issues.
The Prime Minister was asked why he didn't do anything about this interference, even though he was warned in briefing notes, is that he doesn't read briefing notes. Now, we often don't believe the things that this guy says, but I think that most Canadians would believe that defense.
But the Prime Minister has pushed back on that criticism. Take a listen to what Justin Trudeau said during a housing announcement in Vaughan, Ontario.
I read everything that is put in front of me. A Prime Minister takes in massive amounts of information and reads massive amounts of documents. I expect anything that is of particular high importance or relevance to be elevated, and that's what happens.
Well, joining us now is our weekly journalist panel. Robert Fife is the Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, Tonda McCharles, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star, and Joël-Denis Bellivance, the Ottawa Bureau Chief for La Presse. Hello to the three of you.
Thanks for having us.
So listen, let's start with these briefing notes, right? You know, the Prime Minister today, I guess clarifying his earlier testimony, because he says he reads everything but still does rely on in-person briefings to emphasize anything of importance, or at least what security officials think are important. It has opened him up to criticism, Bob, but when you think about it, the Prime Minister does have to be on top of several files. Is that so wrong?
Look, what's going on here is the Prime Minister is trying to dodge a political bullet aimed at him that he was warned by CSIS in some documents that China had interfered in the 2019 and 2020 elections clandestinely and deceptively, and there was a whole range of issues of how they did this. And at the inquiry, he said, well, you know, this October document, I didn't see it. I prefer briefings to be oral, and the CSIS director never told me that. But then we heard from the CSIS director today, which, no, I didn't tell him in that specific briefing because we were dealing with very specific foreign interference problems. I don't know exactly what it was, but he said, look, I've told him this many occasions. Not only did I tell him about China being involved in both elections campaigns, I told him that we're falling behind our allies in countermeasures against foreign interference. And I told him that, you know, there was a disinformation campaign believed to be orchestrated by China against Aaron O'Toole, the Conservative leader at the time, and another MP called Kenny Chu. So he said it all. And I think the Prime Minister, in trying to skate around the testimony on Wednesday, has landed himself in a lot of trouble today. In fact, he even questioned the integrity and the intelligence of CSIS. And at the end of his testimony, the CSIS director said, by the way, the people who work for me are professional. They do very good work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll get to that in a second. But first and foremost, on the Prime Minister essentially saying, yeah, I read everything now, and this is what we heard. What's your reaction to it?
Well, that's more in line with what we've heard about how he deals with briefs in previous occasions, both at parliamentary committees and at the emergencies inquiry, that he does read what's put in front of him. I guess, you know, we can wonder what exactly is put in front of him in the context of the foreign interference inquiry, but I think there's no question that the warnings were there. We've all learned that now, that the warnings have been clear from CSIS that this is an issue. And I think it's still very much, I think, an issue at play as to how exactly the government has acted on some of the specifics, a lot of which we still don't know, right? A lot of this is still in classified documents and in briefings. So I'm hoping that we get a clearer picture of how they specifically responded to specific warnings. Right now, we don't have a clear picture of that. My takeaway from the last couple of weeks is, you know, I wonder if we have the right warning systems in place and if they act quickly enough to alert political parties and the public. And I also wonder if the political parties themselves, you know, in assuming that they know more about the electoral system and what is or isn't interference, are really taking it seriously enough. Perhaps maybe if they think that CSIS doesn't understand how a nominations process works, well, bring them in and explain it. Show their work. Stop telling them. Show it.
Yeah, Jean-Denis.
Well, coming back to the files, whether the prime minister reads them or not, every prime minister has his own style. Like, I mean, Jean Chrétien demanded that a briefing note be on one page only so he could read it, whereas Stephen Harper would read everything on everything, including equalization payments. He would have a big file like this. He would read them all.
Paul Martin would quiz all the bureaucrats over everything for hours on end.
Yeah, and so Mr. Trudeau has obviously his own style. I'm sure he's kept informed of everything. So is there some kind of plausible deniability in this file? Well, who knows? Mm-hmm. But I am very happy that the last person who was on the stand in the commission for this part of the work was David Vigneault, because he did call back to clarify some things. But he did, put things in a very broader perspective. And I think I understand better now how it works and how it did work, thanks to that testimony. But a few takeaways on my part. First of all, I think that Mr. Vigneault underlined the case that the foreign interference from China has been evolving. 2019, it was only a Liberal nomination contest. It was, mixed with some interference activities. Whereas in 2021, it was a whole campaign of disinformation targeting Tory candidates in 2021. What will it be in 2025? I think we need to be ready for that one.
Yeah. I think there are some worrisome questions raised by both the documents and the testimony. Like, there is this reference to $250,000 that supposedly was allegedly meant to be funneled to a number of candidates and staffers. We don't actually know exactly who, what, when, where, how, what happened to that. So that's the kind of thing I'm still left wondering
about.
I've
seen that document, and it doesn't say that the money went to 11 candidates. It says that it was for foreign interference activities, believed to be foreign interference activities in the election of 2019. But it didn't say it went to those.
Yeah.
I think the Prime Minister and the Liberal Party would have a much different perspective on this if they were the ones who were being targeted in 2021. Yeah. I think they would be really saying, we've got to deal with this and deal with this substantively with countermeasures, and we think that CSIS has done a great job. But because it's the Conservatives, he seems to be saying, well, they lost the election. They're a bunch of sore losers. Some of the CSIS intelligence on this is not accurate. The diplomats Chinese diplomats who overheard saying that helped defeat Kenny Chu, oh, well, they're just bragging. There's no evidence that they actually did this. So he's really, really trying to downplay this. I'm sure he wouldn't feel that same way if China was targeting liberals.
Well, let me actually, because I do want to move on here, if it's okay, because it does pick up this point of the tension that we saw in terms of how the PMO treats intelligence briefings from CSIS, because, the Prime Minister said himself, it's his job to question the intelligence that's being given to him.
It's true, because we had cases in the past where secret documents or secret information led to the arrest or transfer, like Maïra, that's a case where, false information was transferred to U.S. that led to the imprisonment of Mr. Arar in Syria. But still, the current situation is the result of CSIS yelling in the desert for so long. Nobody is listening. Crier dans le désert, that's the French expression. So that's, I think CSIS was tired of yelling in the desert. And that's why we're up to this kind of commission. They said it's time to take this issue seriously. And thank goodness we have this commission, because we've learned a lot about it. And I'm hoping that political actors will also learn a lot about this.
Yeah, what would you say to that tension?
Yeah, no, I think that there is a tension there, and I think that it's legit for the government to ask for specifics and whether intelligence is backed up. I have no problem with challenge function of an intelligence service or of a police service, but you know, in many cases, you know, the question becomes: is it political direction? Is it political or deliberate political? Turning aside or turning away or dismissing of the intelligence. I think that's the issue here, right? And I don't have the answer to that yet.
Yeah. Quickly to you before we switch topics.
Oh, I agree that the Prime Minister is right to say that, you know, intelligence should be challenged. I mean, absolutely. But the problem with this is that, as we've all seen from the inquiry, is a lot of information, pretty detailed about what China was up to. Mm-hmm. That's not really to be questioned.
Okay. Well, of course, the inquiry, the public part's wrapped, but the inquiry itself still doesn't work. We'll keep covering this. I do want to talk about the NDP and the carbon tax, though. You smile. let's get people in on this, because we heard a speech from Jagmeet Singh, which seems to imply that they don't believe in the consumer part of the carbon tax anymore. Take a listen to Jagmeet Singh, followed by the Prime Minister.
And it can't be done by letting working people, by letting working families bear the cost of climate change while big polluters make bigger and bigger profits.
So I don't entirely understand the position of the NDP in pulling back both from affordability measures and from the fight against climate change.
And affordability, because the carbon tax is, as liberals say, really a carbon rebate for people to have money at home. But the NDP, the party itself, is pushing back on this idea that they don't believe in the consumer tax anymore. I'll get you to pick that one up, because I know that we've been talking about this before we came on camera.
Yeah. Look, here's the thing. This week, the NDP did two things. They voted in favor of a conservative motion to bring all the premiers, most of which oppose a carbon tax and want the whole consumer carbon price scheme dropped. The NDP supported that. And when asked to explain their vote, they started talking about alternatives. And then the leader gave a big speech yesterday where he put his emphasis on the need to basically make industrial heavy emitters pay the bulk of this. And when we pressed them about what does that mean, does that mean you don't support a consumer carbon price, they were unable to explain their position. And they have continued today to sort of say, our position hasn't changed, but what does that mean? Does that mean they support a consumer carbon price levy along with the rebate? We don't get a clear answer from them. The emphasis this week has been from this party on industrial emitters, and that a consumer carbon price levy, to quote their critic, is not the be-all and end-all. So what are we to understand? At least we can understand that they don't think it's a necessary part of a plan, that the bigger piece is the industrial emitters. And then the other concern that they've emphasized yesterday and today is the need not to make ordinary Canadians deal with the great affordability burden they see the carbon tax as being. So what are we to conclude? Frankly, I'm with the Prime Minister. I don't completely understand where they stand on it now, but they've certainly raised questions about their support for a consumer carbon price levy.
Yeah. I think we can explain the politics of it, though.
Yeah.
They're getting killed.
Well, that is an interesting part of it.
Is getting killed.
We all get the politics.
You know, the Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, has been in those NDP ridings, and they are lots of people showing up at these events, and he is really going hard on the tax. And, you know, I think that is the reason why the NDP are beginning to say, maybe we don't want to hitch our wagon to this one, because it's hurting us in these ridings. And we're already seeing a number of NDP MPs saying, I'm out of here, I'm not running again, And those are MPs in very vulnerable ridings where the Conservatives seem to be doing extremely well.
And a lot of these NDP ridings are orange-blue more than they are orange-red.
But also on the provincial scene, you've got the Liberal government in Newfoundland and Labrador demanding that we drop this, but traditional NDP allies, NDP party provincially in Alberta and Saskatchewan, and to a point in Manitoba where it's the governing party, they are also switching their policies. Mm-hmm. So what is the NDP left with, along with the Liberals who are being clobbered by Pierre Poilievre in the House of Commons? So the end result is probably a policy switch on the fly that we witnessed with the NDP trying now to put back the toothpaste in the dentifrice.
Yeah. They are also going to take a hit on the left of their own party because there are climate action activists within the NDP's ranks that will not like the idea of ditching support for a consumer carbon price. Tax or do or regulate whatever he wants to do with the industrial emitters, all you want, propose that plan. But they would be concerned also if they're dropping their support for the consumer price.
Yeah, and everybody, all the experts acknowledge that this is a very effective way.
It's part
way.
Of the package. Right. Yeah, it's part of the package.
As is part of the rebates, as we keep hearing. So something we're going to keep tracking, out of time, but Bob Tanda, Joel Denis, always appreciate the time. Thank you for
this.
Thanks. Thank you, Michael.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Alberta Premier Danielle Smith calls it her Stay Out of My Backyard bill. On Wednesday, introducing Alberta Bill 18, the Provincial Priorities Act, it pushes back against what Danielle Smith calls the ongoing overreach from Ottawa in provincial affairs by negotiating with municipalities and provincial bodies directly. If passed, the bill would, quote, require provincial entities to obtain prior approval from Alberta's government before entering into, amending, extending, or renewing an agreement with the federal government. In addition to cities and towns, the bill would also apply to public universities and colleges, school boards, and health entities. Well, take a listen to how the Prime Minister is reacting to the bill already.
We recognize that Canadians need help and support and investment and don't so much care about, you know, whose responsibility it is first and foremost. They just want it to get done. And that's why we are there to work hand in hand in full respect with those provinces who want to solve the problem and ask those provinces that don't want to solve the problem to just get out of the way while we solve that problem that Canadians are facing.
Well, happy to say that we are joined in studio today by the Alberta Premier. Danielle Smith, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'll begin with what we heard from the Prime Minister, saying that Canadians don't really care about who pays for something so long as it's solving problems. What's your reaction to what you heard from Justin Trudeau?
Look, I think that people expect fairness out of their federal government. And so when you have a couple of provinces where the federal government deals directly with the premiers and they're able to jointly make an announcement that benefits all municipalities, I think most people think that's pretty fair. That's not what they're doing in Alberta. They're pitting one community against another. They're pitting urban against rural. They're making the municipalities try to jump through hoops to be able to access this funding, and they're not working with us in partnership. So what we decided to do is pass a Provincial Priorities Act, which is very similar to what the Quebec government has passed. And I would note in his announcement, he recognizes that he has to deal with Quebec differently because of that legislation. And what we're asserting is he needs to deal with us in a respectful way because we're getting shortchanged. Our municipalities are getting left out and it's simply not fair.
Okay, except when you mention municipalities, Jody Gondek, the mayor of Calgary, she's already said basically that her city needs investment. And this is money that's on the table right now. So if there's a project that has to be done and someone's willing to pay for it, why not just allow the city, it might be an exception, but a city like Calgary, which needs investment, to actually get it from the federal government?
Well, I would say that Quebec had the most effective way because they were the very first to get an agreement all the way back in November. And in point of fact, if the federal government had taken the same approach with all of the provinces, we'd probably all have had agreements by now, but they haven't. And so what we have in Alberta is where one municipality has one deal, another has another. So there's six small municipalities who also have a third deal, but they've left 350 municipalities out. And in my province, where we are growing faster than we have since 1972, where we are finding that 20 to 25% of all newcomers to the country are coming to Alberta, even though we're only 12% of the population, we have greater demands and greater needs than almost any other province. And we think the federal government should work in partnership with us rather than make political announcements.
Now, to my understanding, the bill introduced, Bill 18, they're there will be consultations on it with municipalities in the summer. Does that mean then that municipalities and other provincial entities have to stop any type of negotiation that is currently happening with federal officials?
Well, we have said that it will be our expectation on a go forward, and it's not going to be retroactive. But I would hope most municipalities would receive it in the spirit that we intended, that we are already shortchanged by our calculation compared to what we're seeing in other provinces, $1 to $2 billion in housing funding. And so we are using this as a mechanism so that every municipality is able to get fair treatment. That's the intention.
Okay, that's the intention. Although, you know, I'm going to read you a quote here, and this was not an interview with us, but this is Jared Wesley, who's a political scientist at U of A. He did an interview with the CBC, and this is what he said. This suggests they're not interested in getting more dollars necessarily, but that this may actually be punitive for institutions that disagree ideologically with the government. What do you say to that?
Look, we have done a cursory review of various agreements that we have. We've got 14,000 agreements. The ones that are potentially problematic are only about 800. Because where we find that we have a difference of opinion on the federal with the federal government is their speed with which they want to achieve a net zero target. We believe that we can be aligned if we go on a 2050 net zero target. We have a difference of opinion as well on the issue of safe supply. We don't support it because we support an approach that puts recovery first. So those are the kind of things that we are potentially looking at as being problematic. But I don't think the federal government should be using its federal spending power to come into provincial agencies that we fund and we establish through legislation to try to circumvent our policy priorities. That's all that this is about. And on areas where we can work collaboratively, and I think that we have demonstrated that we can, we've worked together on a healthcare deal, which we did collaboratively. That's the thing I find the most frustrating, is they know how to do this work. They've done it with us before. We signed a 10-year deal, including four side deals, because they came to us. They didn't try to go around to each individual hospital to try to get a separate deal with each hospital. It's not appropriate. They know how to do this right. They should do it right in the spirit of cooperative federalism.
Do you see this as a purposeful tactic on behalf of the federal government rather than, you know, Calgary is expressing a need, Edmonton is expressing a need, let's try to figure this out with municipalities? Or do you think it's far more to undermine your government?
Well, all I can say is that they have demonstrated that when they want to work with us, that they do work with us. There are some ministers who I think we have a very good relationship with. This has been an anomaly, and maybe it's because they're facing pressure from the opposition party, so they feel they have to be in a mad rush, and so they're short-circuiting an appropriate process. But it's not acceptable, because what we need to do is we need to address what the need is and make sure that we're funding the municipalities who need the support in a way that brings both federal and provincial dollars to the table at the same time, as opposed to trying to score political points. That's how I'm perceiving this.
Okay, if it is a time frame crunch for the federal government, as you know, one potential that you suggest, are you willing to work with the federal government on an expedited time frame in order to meet their own goals?
Well, look, I've told my seniors, community and social services minister, who is responsible for housing, to do whatever we can to accelerate housing. As I said, I mean, we have had 200,000 people increase our population over the last year. We're getting 20 to 25% of the Ukrainian evacuees have been coming to our province. This is a dire need for us as well in Alberta, and so we are doing everything we can to reduce red tape, to identify specific projects that will accelerate housing. And it would just be really nice, knowing that we're doing all this work, to have the federal government working in sync with us as a partner, as opposed to working at cross purposes.
You know, I can't help but note the fact that you are in Ottawa for 24 hours. At the same time, the Prime Minister and the Housing Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, all of whom were in Vaughan, Ontario, so a good 4.5-hour drive from the nation's capital. Did you try to coordinate some type of meeting to actually have a discussion with them face-to-face about your concerns?
I do always, when I come to Ottawa, reach out to ministers to see if we can meet. This time around, I did want to meet with Mark Miller because, as I mentioned, we've got a very serious issue with making sure that we have enough spaces in our provincial nominee program for newcomers from Ukraine to be able to use that program. We haven't had much success on that. So I do reach out to ministers every time I come here, hoping to be able to meet with them. We just weren't able to do that this time.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about these dollars and how you're essentially trying to set up a parameter where the federal government has to go through the provincial government mm-hmm. in order to negotiate these deals, if as a result of this process that you're now going to set up, if dollars do not make their way to municipalities and provincial entities, will the province make up the dollars that the federal government is offering?
Well, I can tell you what I would expect to see. I would expect to see that they would deal with us in good faith. I think that the provinces in the past have been very successful in having a united front in saying that we should all be getting our equal per capita share. We all have housing needs. We all have infrastructure needs. We all have transportation project needs. And I think we're all having the same frustration that the federal government seems to be pitting one province against the other. It's not an appropriate way for them to be conducting themselves. And I think you'll probably hear the premier say more about that as we go forward with our COF meetings.
Now, you yourself say there are certain ministers that you find you can work with fairly well. Do you care to name them? so that there might be an example for the federal government?
I often text François-Philippe Champagne. In fact, I was just texting him yesterday as well, because the federal government is making great progress on getting the Trans Mountain pipeline to the finish line, which is going to be such a great project, not only for us, but for Canada as a whole. And it's just one example of the kind of things that I think the federal government should be focused on, that kind of critical infrastructure to be able to help us get our goods to market. And so I will express gratitude when they're doing their job well. The problem is they should be doing their job well and stop trying to do all of the premier's jobs. If they want to work with us, happy to partner with them, but they shouldn't be trying to do workarounds on us.
You know, so much of a relationship is about the relationship at the top. I'm wondering how you would describe your relationship with the Prime Minister right now, what you want to see or how you want to see that relationship develop?
You know, I've had a number of occasions to talk with him. When I find it especially urgent, I make sure to reach out and have a meeting or a phone call. But at the moment, I would say that what all the premiers are looking for is a first minister's conference. We haven't had one where we get together as premiers with the prime minister at the table to talk about our key issues. One thing we put on the table was the carbon tax, which even their NDP coalition partner is saying is not performing the way it should and is questioning whether or not it should continue, and also urging him to meet with the premiers. We would talk about housing. We would talk about asymmetric federalism. We would talk about them meeting their targets when it comes to supporting Indigenous nations for healthcare and a variety of other things. And so I would say at the moment, what I'd like to see is a first minister's conference so all of us together can have this conversation about how our relationship should work.
Okay. Well, you didn't answer the question, but I'm out of time. But I'm going to pick it up again another time. But until then, Premier Daniel Smith,
we'll
always appreciate
time.
The time.
Thank you.
Take care. And that is our program for this weekend. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching. We'll see you on the next Primetime Politics.